Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio. No, this is Rebooting the News with Jay Rosen and me, Dave Weiner. Jay, are you there?
I'm here, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing all right. You know, the Yankees lost, so it's a pretty good day all around when the Yankees lose. I don't know how you feel. I never asked, are you a Yankees fan?
No, I'm not a baseball fan.
Oh, really? I am a lifelong baseball fan and, you know, rooting for the Angels, you know, hard as that is for me to do because, you know, we're a California guy and the Angels beat the Giants a few years back in the World Series.
I'm waiting for the NBA to start.
Oh, are you a Knicks fan?
No, I'm not a Knicks fan, but I'm an NBA fan.
Let's see, what team would you be a fan of then?
Well, I wish I had one. But I'm also a Rebooting the News fan. And so we
are we going to do that? Okay,
yeah, we
Rebooting the Sports.
Right.
No, anyway.
So what
are we talking about this week, Jay?
Well, let's start off with FriendFeed.
Oh, FriendFeed. How interesting. Well, you know, we use FriendFeed as part of Rebooting the News. And,
yes, we do.
But I don't know if you've noticed this. And this is, you know, sort of like let's out of the blue. Have you noticed that it's like a little bit more quiet over there these days?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, so have a lot of other people. And you know that FriendFeed got acquired by Facebook
some time
ago. And there was some sense of maybe this was the end for FriendFeed. And I guess this is a Rebooting the News topic only insofar as, you know, there's almost a cautionary tale of, like, don't depend too much on small, thinly funded startup companies that, you know, don't put all your eggs in those baskets because, you know, they may sell out to Facebook.
Right. It's kind of psychological, isn't it? It's once people get the impression that the developer's energy isn't really going into FriendFeed anymore, but now into Facebook, it's almost like people conclude that, oh, so we know now what FriendFeed is going to become. It's already become what it's going to become.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they don't want to invest their own creativity in it because it's sort of reached the horizon. That's what it seemed like to me.
But yes, I think that's exactly right. But it almost seems illogical to do that. I mean, it works perfectly fine.
Right, it's still going.
It works just as well today as it worked the day before they got acquired.
That's why I'm still using it for exactly the same thing I used to use it for.
Yeah, and we are, except there isn't the discussion that used to happen. I mean, that was the reason to use Facebook FriendFeed as opposed to using Twitter, is that, you know, you could get this, you know, nice sort of back and forth.
Mm.
You know, we have not a very large community in FriendFeed, but we have some people who follow us there, and and you could get their contribution into the show, and it was sort of building some momentum. I think this goes back to sort of a lesson that that I learned many years ago, is that software is a process. It's not something, you know, that you can sort of view, and, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm a user of the New York Times, and they just published their last issue, and I'll just keep reading that issue, right? I mean, it's just as good today as it was yesterday, right? Sooner or later, you kind of want to see some new features. You're kind of like a fan of the process, not just of how you're using it, but you want to see how they're going to respond to it. And that was part of the fun of FriendFeed was, you know, they were moving, and sometimes they were moving in ways you liked and sometimes in ways that you didn't like.
Yeah.
And it all sort of gave it, that was sort of had an interest to it, you know, and there's no motion there whatsoever. It's pretty much is probably all that it will ever be.
It does illustrate something about web development, which is that if there isn't an open end to it, if there isn't motion and momentum, it kind of grinds to a halt even if it is still useful.
Yes. Now, there's another angle to look at this, too, is that what if it had been open source? What if everything about it had been open? And then there could never be an end to the process.
Right. That's the whole genius of open source.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like why I'm doing the, you know, loosely coupled 140-character message network, which, by the way, I'm still very much working on.
Mm-hmm.
and is doing it is entirely more than open source. It's like a whole community of open source projects. And you know, if one of them should fall by the wayside and stop being maintained, just switch to another one.
Right.
They're all exactly equivalent to each other. They may have certain amenities that the other might not have or might have. You know, there are certainly advantages to using one or over the other, but they're plug compatible. And you know, the same thing could happen to Twitter. I mean, it's harder to imagine that Twitter could get acquired, you know, in the same way that FriendFeed did.
Mm-hmm.
But they could get acquired in a different way, or they could get competed with and lose interest in the network that we depend on and create some other network or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're better off in general if you bet on the open system versus, you know, betting on the corporation.
Yeah, that's because if it dies, it's not for an arbitrary reason, like somebody decided to buy it or somebody decided to leave,
mm-hmm.
but because it simply ran out of human momentum. It lost users because it lost their imagination.
Well, and, you know, it's not always a bad bet to bet on the corporate systems either. I mean, if you look at Windows, had you bet on creating Windows software in, say, 1991 or 92,
mm-hmm.
your bet would still be good.
Right, true.
So, I mean, and you kind of have to judge each situation uniquely. I made a bet on Windows software in the mid-1990s, and no regrets there. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it all continues to work. They haven't blown up the platform. They've actually done a fairly good job of managing it. So, you know, while I may not like Microsoft the corporation, which I more or less don't, I do use their software. So it's not always a bad bet. You sort of have to use your... You have to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to ask you something about the loosely coupled 1-800-40 character.
Sure.
And the development of that system. Are people working on, I don't even know what the name for this is, on 140 character messages that could carry much more metadata or enclosures
mm-hmm.
than Twitter does? Because it's something I've been thinking much more about after you initially put the idea in my head. And I really would like to see that happen. I would like to see what it looks like when you can add to the 140-character message itself, add a link, add some tags, add a, let's say, a conversation this relates to, add tags and people to whom it should be addressed, right? All these things that I would like to have on there. Is somebody working on that part?
Well, there's no work to be done, as a matter of fact, Jay. I think someday I should, like, offer a one-week crash course of RSS for poets. you know,
you're calling me a poet now. That's good. I like that.
Yeah, well, you are a poet. Are you kidding? If somebody were asking me for a prime example of a poet, I think I would say Jay Rosen, of course. I'm not kidding. I'm not good with sarcasm, and if I'm being sarcastic, the joke won't work. I'm actually serious.
I like it.
You're smart enough to be dangerous, but you're missing a little bit of information here, because you know the infrastructure of the loosely coupled 140 character network is RSS, and if you were to look at the RSS 2.0 spec, what you would see is that it allows for all the things that you just asked for. And, in fact, anything that it doesn't allow for, you can add because it has an open architecture to it. You can add new data to it. But that's okay because it already has most of the things that you asked for. It has the ability to do an enclosure. The links are not do not have to be part of the message text, which is sort of like we know so well that this is one of the major architectural flaws of Twitter,
right.
is that the links have to go and be part of the 140 characters. It's, you know, terrible waste of, and it's created all this problem with the URL shorteners, you know.
Right.
Because now you have to try to get those things to be small so they don't take up too many characters, right? So you have some space
right.
left for your writing. Truth be told, I call it a 140-character network, but there actually is no limit anywhere in the RSS 2.0 spec that says that the message text can only be 140 characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's by convention that
mm-hmm.
it might be that, and it would
mm-hmm.
be up to each processor in there to decide whether or not they like that limit or not. And I sort of hope that at some point what happens is that news organizations start operating these nodes in this network, and that they start asking the question, are we limited to 140 characters? At which point, as a technologist, I would say, well, no, you're actually not. You could have more. And then I would turn it around and ask them the question is, what do you think the right number of characters is? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, unlimited probably isn't the right answer. You know?
Right.
Right? Because synopses have limits. And if you
sure.
were to ask, do you know offhand what is there a convention for the length of a synopsis?
I don't know the answer to that, no.
Okay. It would be interesting to find out. I mean, is there a style guide somewhere? Do publications have conventions on that? Is there any agreement amongst the publications?
There might be. Like, for example, I believe that the New York Times Index, which goes back a long way and has been, in fact, a software project, has abstracts of articles, and they probably have some kind of length. So that might be one place to start.
Right. And I think that they're much better able to answer the question than we are, than technology guys are. I mean,
you want to hear
really
what my requested fields would be on this metadata enclosure question?
Are you asking me if I want to know those? Of course.
Yeah.
Of course I do.
Well, I want the ability to have a title for my post. I want
you do? Really?
The link to be added.
Why do you want a title for your post?
Because sometimes they have titles.
Even the 140 characters?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Or you could say it's a subject line. The link.
Jay, I wonder about that. It with 140 characters, how long would the title be?
A couple of words, three, four words.
Three, four words, something like that. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wait,
I'm gonna write this down. Title.
Title.
Yeah.
Link.
Yeah.
What it's replying to.
What it's replying to. So
yeah.
That might be, okay.
If it's a reply to a particular post.
What? It's.
And at least two addressees, as people I could tag as this is related to you or of interest to you or you should.
Well, that's one of the standard fields in a tweet, right? I mean, if it's in reply to, what it's in reply to.
It could be in reply to anything.
Doesn't have to be in reply to a tweet. It could be in reply to something else.
Yeah.
So what kind of data is in reply to? What is that, a link or is that a piece
it's a
of
link.
Text? It's a link.
Yeah.
I see. And that's different from the link that,
I'm pointing people to, yes.
Okay. All right.
And then people that I want to tag as, I'm talking to you, buddy.
And you're not just talking to the world, so we're just eavesdropping in on something.
Well, I am talking to the world, but I might want to say that I'm talking to you.
The guy at technology.
Jeff Jarvis, or I'm talking to you, Howard Owens, you know?
Okay.
Then I want Howard Weaver, Howard Owens, both of them.
Okay.
And then I want a way to possibly say this is yet another elaboration on my Church of the Savvy theme.
Ah, so it might be a category.
Yeah, category.
Okay.
And that should do it, Dave.
Okay. Well, no, I bet there are, when you do the show notes for this thing, for this
mm-hmm.
episode, make sure to point to the RSS 2.0 spec that's stored at cyber.law.harvard.edu. Okay?
Sure will.
That's the canonical spec. And then... seriously, let's go through it, okay? I mean, and you'll see, it's written in English, Jay. It's not written in gobbledygook. And,
mm-hmm.
and let's see what of those things that are there fit the bill for you. Certainly, the title and the link are there. They're actually called title and link, all right?
There you go.
And, I mean, the three key elements in an item in RSS are title, link, and description.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, and you understand better than I do what those things are because they came out of the news business.
Right.
They came out, I promise you, that's exactly where it came from. The category element is there, and it's quite flexible. I've lately been studying the way the New York Times is using RSS. because they've done many levels of review of it. And so you might think that their use of it now is fairly mature, and I hadn't looked at it in a while. And they're doing some really nice stuff in there now. And so it's a really good time to, you know, this is so right in the middle of the rebooting the news theme, because mm-hmm. we're talking, you know, news and technology, right? And
right.
RSS is right there. And the way the Times is using it is for, very much on my radar, because I've been hacking at their stuff this week and with some really incredible results, which brings me to something I want to talk about.
Yes, the real-time New York Times feed.
The real-time New York Times feed, right. And this came out of a conversation that I had with Jennifer Preston.
Yes,
who is their
social media
social editor
for New York Times.
At the Times. I've talked with her a number of times, as I know you have.
Yes, I have.
She's sort of been talking to people in our area. And when we came out with the, you know, I think it was in early September when we had the WordPress deal, I was, you know, saying, okay, we need the New York Times. And, you know, it sort of wasn't clear exactly how we were going to get that. But so now I've picked it up again. And I thought we would use WordPress, but instead I just did a really, what we call in technology, an egregious hack. it's really bad, but it works. Those are the best kinds of egregious hacks, you know, mm-hmm. the ones that actually work. And I put a cloud element in. I made every minute I read their most recent headlines feed, and I check the length of it in characters. And if the length has changed, then I assume there's new content in the feed. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's just a file. And if the length changed, I figure there's new content. And so then what I do is I add a cloud element to the text, and I write it out on one of my servers, static.newsriver.org, and I ping my cloud server to tell it that this feed is updated.
Hmm.
And I'm using the protocol, the RSS cloud protocol, to do this, and it works.
Hmm.
And so you can, if you have a cloud-aware aggregator, feed reader, you can subscribe to a real-time New York Times feed. And, of course, I happen to have one of those. And I've been using it, and it's fantastic.
Hmm.
I mean, it really does, when it, they really do track the news, and they really are real-time. And so it's everything I ever hoped it would be. So now I've got CNN, and I've got GigaOM, and I've got TechCrunch, and I've got the New York Times. And I'm starting to feel pretty real-time over there in the news space.
Hmm. Very
yeah.
interesting.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how I can show this to people, though. You know, how can I illustrate to them what this feels like? Because most people don't have one yet. I'm trying to figure that one out.
Well, speaking of CNN, I was on a panel in Las Vegas this week with Don Lemon, who is a one of the anchors on CNN. He's on during
mm-hmm.
the day
sure.
a lot of times. And
he's also on Twitter.
He's on Twitter.
And what, he got like 18 million followers or something?
No, not that many. And so he was at Blog World with me, and we were on this panel sort of on trends in the news business. And we had a fine discussion. He's a good guy, and he is certainly aware of social media, and he's eager to learn and to grow. But the next day, he was back on the air in Atlanta, and I turned on my television set in the hotel room, and he's doing an item on Balloon Dad, you know, a totally wretched story from beginning to end that, of course, cable news completely overplayed and just indulged in for several days. And earlier in the day, Gawker had come out with a pretty nice story that they kind of violated journalistic protocol for by paying for it. But it was from a former assistant to the Balloon Dad who told stories that strongly suggested that this dad was very interested in cultivating publicity and totally capable of a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
And the story was all over Twitter. It had been commented on a lot. It was, as I said, strongly suggestive that this wasn't just as sort of an innocent player, and not a word of it occurred in Don Lemon's update on CNN. And he was what he was reporting was that Balloon Dad had come out of his house and placed a box in the driveway and said he would answer all questions if the media would just put their questions in this box, right? Of course, he never did that, but the news was that he had placed this box on the...
Were you watching this?
I was watching this in my hotel room because... his report on the conference was...
No, you had the interest in Don Lemon, obviously.
Yeah, because I had just been on a panel with him, right?
Yeah,
he is on my television set. And he was going to do a report on the conference, and he had been putting together this report.
Okay, you justified it. I'm not going to attack you again on that one. Although I was tempted to.
Yeah, right. So what the heck is this? I mean, all he had to do was check Twitter...
Yeah.
Before he does his item,
right.
And he could say there's a report from Gawker that's strong, you know, and then he doesn't have to endorse it or say this is the God's truth. He just has to say there's a report about it, and it's certainly as reliable as Balloon Dad putting a box in front of his driveway, you know.
To think that was news,
I mean, that
is amazing. That's a farce.
Exactly.
You know, 24 hours later, Don Lemon, CNN, I think that's his handle, posts a thing. I saw this, you know, in my feed. It was, I don't remember the exact text, but it was like, oh, my God, the thing is a hoax.
Yeah.
In all caps with exclamation part.
Exactly.
It was 24 hours after the Gawker, which, of course, I read the Gawker article.
Right.
And, you know, I figured they paid good money for it. I should read it, right? And it's 24 hours. There's Don Lemon. I mean, I think the reason that he didn't talk about it is pretty obvious. They wanted to get another 24 hours out of it. And if they were reporting that Gawker, you know, knew for a fact that it was a hoax, well, then they wouldn't get the 24 hours, would they?
Well, you know, if you want to be real time, then be real time. You know,
they
don't want to be real time.
Don Lemon might be a really nice guy, and, you know, maybe you want to go out for drinks with him, but he's not about news. I mean... my feeling was when I found out it was a hoax, I said, good, I'm excused from watching this because I didn't watch it on the way up, so I don't have to watch it on the way down.
Me neither.
Look at all the time I saved.
If ever there was a non-story, this is it.
I was willing to watch that one from the sidelines. Oh, there's a balloon in Colorado. Isn't that interesting? And I went out for a walk or I did something else. I am so not into the news these days. I mean, that's, you know.
Well, that wasn't even news. Now, meanwhile, speaking of forward motion and moving forward, Twitter introduced lists.
Yes.
They kind of introduced it to some. And I wondered if you
had
any...
We're getting a nice flow to this thing, aren't we? It's almost like we do this like for a living.
We're professional.
You segued there. It was very, very good.
So I wanted to ask if you had any comments on this feature.
I mean, they're intriguing. I must have spent 5 hours on the phone with Scoble talking about it. Scoble is, of course, you know, like obsessing in great detail over the details of the feature and doing a great job. So he's found the limits. You can only have 20 lists. Each user can only have 20 lists.
Mm-hmm.
And there can only be 500 items per list. I started, you know, I needed an example to work with, and as I know you did too. I started... Because I already have a Berkeley, I was doing these special websites for, you know, various different categories of tweeters.
Right, like the New York Times tweeters.
That's right, and for the top 100 people and for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and we did one for Berkeley, And so I said, okay, I'll just do this for Berkeley and see what the difference is. There's no difference. It's the same thing, only it's a better way of doing it because I didn't need to start another account. In order to do the Berkeley one, to do each one of those ones, I started a new Twitter account. And in order to add somebody to the list, I would just follow that person. Right. And so now it's almost like having 20 new Twitter accounts for each user,
right?
You can figure out who you want them to follow, and you can change it, you know, as you wish. And So it's great. I mean, it will immediately change a lot of the ways Twitter is used. For example, I was at a conference. I'm going to Jeff Pulver's 140 character
right.
in Los Angeles. And normally what they would do at a conference is they would say, you know, all your tweets should be #140CONF or something
right.
like that, right? And here we go. We're using up some of our 140 characters again, and it's something
Which
you have
annoying.
To remember to do, and it's kind of a pain in the butt and whatever. Well, now you don't have to do it. He's
mm-hmm.
created a list of all the people that are at the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if Twitter should happen to turn the feature on for everybody by that time, which you got to wonder if they actually, when they will do it. They've said, you know, a few weeks or something or a few days or nobody really knows. If they have it, then you won't need to do the pound sign.
Right.
You won't need to do the hashtags. So hashtags may become a lot less important. On the other hand, it may turn out that only the most anal retentive people in Twitterville will actually do this, because you kind of do have to be fairly anal retentive to
there's some work. Yeah.
It's work, and then it's maintenance. And there's a certain kind of feature, a software feature. Dan Bricklin, who's, you know, one of the authors of VisiCalc, a very, very smart guy that I've known for like 30 years, he has a really great way of putting it. He says, you look for software features that reward you for using them 1% of the time, and unfortunately there are a lot of products that penalize you for not using them 100% of the time. And lists are probably in the latter category.
Mm-hmm.
So if you stop, it's like a calendar is like that, or a to-do list, those, you know, all the things that fall into the category of personal information managers, if you don't use them 100% of the time, you start feeling guilty about not having used them.
Right.
And then you don't want to even look about it. You don't even want to think about it, you know. And the list might be like that. It might be one of those things where if you forget to put a bunch of people on there and you get somebody, you know, like on my Berkeley list, you know, yeah, I'm doing pretty good about it, though. I'm maintaining it, and I've stopped maintaining the account. So that should give you a clue. This is a lot easier. So I do.
Right, but you know what? That immediately suggests that news organizations have an advantage, because if
yes.
they do maintain their lists,
yes.
right, of
yes.
the best people to follow on Twitter who care about Las
yes.
Vegas sports,
yes.
then they have an advantage, because lots of people will be too lazy to maintain their lists, and the news
right.
organizations won't.
That's
and
a
so
really
it
good point.
It
yeah,
becomes
a crowdsourced
product.
Might not be a very good approach.
Right.
Yeah. On the other hand, there's I don't want to like move off that too fast, because I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a good point, and I think it's a good thing to point out for the people who are in news organizations listening to this, that this is something they definitely should be focusing on. But it's possible. Look at this alternative way of doing it. What if you lived in Berkeley, okay, and you kept a list called Berkeley, and of course I'm keeping one, and say 25 other people keep a list. So if I drop mine, and let's say you could join these lists, right? So you could have a list that was the union of all of the Berkeley lists.
Mm-hmm.
And now if I drop mine, it's not such a big deal.
Right. A
right?
list of lists.
Or, yes. Well, there's two ways
like
to do it.
Like a fund of funds.
Right. You know, it's a pool, or a pool might be a better way of looking at it. It's sort of like you pool them all. Now, to be honest, I've already done this, okay, in that, you know, I found somebody else who had a Berkeley list, and I went through it, and they had, you know, a fair number of people there who I'd never heard of, and, of course, I added them all to my list.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it felt a little dishonest when I was doing it, but I did it anyway, you know, because...
See, I wouldn't mind that. If people take my young newsies, I have a young journalist list.
Yep.
If people take it and they add some of those people to whatever list they're doing, that's fine with me. Open is open.
Yes. You're one exceptional human being, Jay. You're not everybody is on the par with you in that way. I mean, it's, again, no sarcasm intended. I mean, there will be people who mind that, though.
Hmm.
Yeah. Which,
right.
by the way...
But then they have no business in open platforms. That's my philosophy.
Correct. But Twitter's not an open platform.
It isn't?
No.
Oh.
Is it? You think
well,
it is?
When lists are public, that as far as I'm concerned, it's open. It's like anybody.
It's pretty open. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. I once had a teacher who asked a question of the class and said, "Now, children, you may either tell the truth, you can decline to answer, you can tell the truth, or you can lie." And this really confused everybody. But of course, you can lie. You know, that's what he said when everybody asked him to explain. So yes, it may not be legal for you to copy other people's. It may be an infringement on copyright even, you know. But how are you going to stop people from doing it, right?
That's very true.
Yeah. Which is the problem we had with inberkeley.com.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Nice.
And now I want to make, there are two things I want to make sure we talk about this week. One is that, and the Future Safe Archive thing is very, very important. And
Well, you better get to it. You only have
15 minutes. Yeah, I think I better get to it. And the inberkeley.com thing is quite sensitive. So I want to be careful up front because there are some conclusions. And I just to mention that you and I have talked about this offline. We have, you know, I told you about what I was going to do before I did it. And so give you a chance to comment on it, get your feedback and so forth. I wanted to do that because I was sure we would talk about it on the show and wanted to make sure I had a chance to consider your point of view on it before doing anything there, because inberkeley.com was kind of a lab in a way for a lot of the things we talk about here. You know, the idea was let's just open a community website and see what happens. And the people we attracted were largely former reporters. And what I want to be careful about is not in any way drawing conclusions about all reporters from this or reading too much into any of this stuff, okay? The same way I wouldn't like it if a reporter said they, you know, had some bloggers involved in what they were doing and for whatever reason it didn't work out very well, that they would somehow blame bloggers for it. It really wouldn't be cool. So I don't want to do that, but I just want to sort of describe the experience and then see, you know, what you have to say and, you know, whatever anybody else has to say about it. Because I think that the way there's a difference between the way reporters approach problems, professional news people approach problems, and the blogger way of approaching a problem. Mm-hmm. So let's say, and I wrote a piece about this, and I gave an example. Let's say there was a parade on Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley. You weren't there, but you heard about it. Feel like you have enough information to write a story. So you write the story, but you need a picture, right? And you feel like the picture is so important that I can't run the story without the picture. So this is a point of division where a reporter and a blogger will do two very different things. What the blogger will do is they'll put the story up as it is and say, does anybody have a picture? Because I really think this should have a picture. Was anybody at the parade? And if you have a picture, send it to me, and I'll put it on the story. The reporter doesn't run the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, or...
Have the picture.
What's that? Until they have a picture. Or, even worse, the reporter goes to a professional news organization's website and takes their picture and puts it on their story. Right? Now, I think we all agree that's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. The last thing, that's... You can't do that. It's also not very smart because when you look at it as a competitive situation, it is a competitive situation. And that news organization that you took the picture from is not only going to object, they might use it against you.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
Not only that, and this is an actual dilemma that I had, and I had it twice. It came up twice. The first time it came up, we said to everybody, you just can't do this. And if it happens again, we've got to do something really drastic. And it happened again. And, you know, my nightmare scenario is I end up giving a talk at some conference. And there's a reporter in the audience. And I'm talking about rebooting the news, like we talk about on the show, right? And the reporter says, now, isn't it true that you can't do an amateur news site without scarfing content from the professional news sites, and if that's true, how can any of this work? And that is what we did not prove at inberkeley.com. We did not prove that you can actually do it without scarfing the content from the professional news site, and that to me is major disappointment.
And you shut down inberkeley.com.
Yeah, that's why I shut down inberkeley.com. Exactly, because after the first time it happened, I was constantly nervous, stressed out about what if it happens again. It's like, what if it's worse the second time? Because the first time it happened, we actually ran a complete story from the San Francisco Chronicle. Almost every word in the story appeared in our site. And it was like, whoa, where did you get the idea that we do this?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, you know, so, yeah, it happened again, and I said, and I got a lot of people just said, oh, well, you shouldn't be so upset about this or whatever. And I said, well, I think I have to be this upset about it because this ain't working. If we're going to do this, it has to work very, 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 very differently from this.
Well, I thought it was good news that BerkeleySide.com emerged from that by people who wanted to carry on with what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good when people do their own thing and decide that they want to try it their way, because it's really hard to do these sites. It's really very difficult to do
Yes. A
good local site, no matter how you're doing it. Even if you had a paid staff, it would be hard to do.
No, I don't want to have a paid staff.
I know, but I'm saying,
I mean,
no matter which way you cut it,
requirement, no paid staff. I mean, if we have a paid staff, you're going to end up in exactly the same place where the, you know, news industry is,
mm-hmm.
you know, with a system that isn't working very well.
Right. So it's a very tough thing to crack, and I think one of the fascinating things to me about the quandary that the newspaper industry is in is a lot of the people who work for Metropolitan Newspapers somehow got the impression that they were very good local news sources, but for most people who live in the cities that were served by these metropolitan mm-hmm. newspapers, they rarely covered news of your street, of your neighborhood, of
yeah.
your school, of your park, you know? They never
yeah.
got down to that level. And that's what's still missing from the news system.
We'll crack it, Jay. It'll happen. And once there's a good example...
Well, it's being cracked.
Once,
here and there it's being cracked, but it's a big challenge.
Once there's a good example, then it's going to start blossoming everywhere. Because
yeah.
we'll have something to point to, and we'll say, okay, this is how you need to do it. That was one of the problems that I had here, was that the only examples that I could point to were, you know, my experience with blogging, podcasting, and RSS, okay, which worked that way. I mean, you know, we bootstrapped the blogging community, you know, and all its various shades, you know, simply there was never a problem. It was never a problem. I mean, basically, you know, it was all done by the Tom Sawyer method, you know, the whitewashing the fence and, gee, that looks great. Can I do it? You know, it was more complicated than that. But fundamentally, that did scale up and work. That is how it grew. Right, and then, you know, 9/11 happened, and that's when you get the political blogosphere starts booting up, and a couple of years later you have the 2004 election, and that gets a whole other level of these things going. You know, for whatever reason, local has got its own unique problems, and I don't know what they are, because we haven't cracked it yet. But I'm going to also take another stab at this, Jay. I really want to do that, and I needed a fresh start, too. So, you know, I think we will all learn from this.
Yeah.
And it's possible that my former colleagues that have now started a new thing, it's possible that they're listening to me much better now than they did before.
Well,
that's crossed
my
mind.
Yeah, maybe they'll crack it.
Well, having drawn this line in the sand and, you know, made this, you know, very dramatic sort of, here, this is where we part ways, you know, that at this point I think I probably am getting through. Maybe not. I don't know. It doesn't matter, really.
My current interest is the news cafe model, where the news cafe model, newsroom as a
oh,
cafe.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like you start the whole hyperlocal site, not just as a blog site, but as a cafe where people can
right.
both hang out and get news as well as
yeah.
report news and get an assignment, coupled with this trend called co-working, where people...
Yeah.
come together and share the costs of internet connections and office space. And I just think that somewhere in there, the combination of newsroom as cafe, co-working space, people who are hanging out, and
mm-hmm.
it's a place where you can get news, deposit news, get an assignment, and it has an online expression as well. somewhere in that mix of elements might be an interesting formula for a local news site. I'm hoping that somebody will give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
You said you had another thing you wanted to make sure we got to.
Yeah, Future Safe Archives.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's yeah, we have all 5 minutes left, so there's no way to cover this in entirety, anything remotely like entirety in the time that we have left. Let me just say that the problem comes up every time one of my relatives passes away. And it comes front and center, and you know, it's always with me because these sites that I inherit, they all have websites. Everybody in my family has websites. And I think that's going to become, I think that is now a much more commonplace thing than it obviously ever has been. And so the question I have, and of course I have this like sprawling web presence, you know. It's just every day I buy another domain, like start another website and, you know, whatever. And I've really tried to limit that because, you know, I'm not getting younger. And, you know, and then because I understand this problem so well for, you know, I mean, it's not just with relatives who pass, by the way. It's like it happened with the RSS 2.0 spec. You know, I donated it to Harvard and then it was relicensed under the Creative Commons. And then I sort of forgot about it. And then 2 years later, it was the archive wasn't there anymore, you know, and so I said, okay, I think I better do another pass over this, you know, and get it all straightened out and make it so that it survives. And so far, so good. It has, you know, I did it a whole new way, and created something that was, you know, defended against the future, you know, and so that's why I call it Future Safe Archives, because you know we create these things. And I think there's an expectation that they're going to be around, you know. But, in fact, you know, the awful truth, for me at least, is that my website and every website that I maintain will be gone 30 days after I die. This vulnerability, and then take care of that, and then do it again, and do it again, and do it again, and hopefully not over too long a period of time, because, you know, in academia, by the way, this is also a huge problem, because, you know, you have professors who are putting their life work on the internet, and, you know, the librarians have this problem when the professor retires or passes on, well, what are they going to do? How do they even locate the archives anymore? It used to be they'd have these cardboard boxes in the professor's office, and I know this because I looked into this when I was at Harvard, and, you know, they have the cardboard boxes in a warehouse and just don't know what to do with them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's an opportunity here to do much, 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 much better, and it's also potentially a business, and I think in order to work, it has to be a really good business, and I think universities play a big role in this, and I think news organizations play a big role as well.
You know, it reminds me of something. One of the deepest things in journalism. It's the notion of a public record. You know, the notion of the record, which we refer to when we say on the record, off the record, is really a construct. It's a fiction, but it's a very important fiction because, let's face it, there's nowhere you can go to look up the record, right? But the idea of getting things on the record and that when they are on the record, it's sort of a permanent record, is very basic to journalism because journalism is constantly doing that. It's adding to the public record. But if the public record can itself disappear, then it kind of adds almost a fatalistic element to journalism itself. So it's a very important issue that you're raising. The permanence of the public record is in a way related to the durability of fact itself.
Absolutely. You've got it. And here's the irony of it, okay? So today, it's much worse in the electronic world than it was in the print world, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's part one of the irony. Part two is, it could be much better.
Yeah.
So it's all whacked. It's all wrong, you know. Let's go a little bit over. We can, by the way, go a little over.
Okay.
Yeah, the first time I got clued into this was an article I read in the New York Times a number of years ago about John Steinbeck's work. And there's a museum, you know, he lived in the Monterey area.
Monterey Bay, yeah.
Yeah, and they were finding that that they weren't sure that all of his stuff was surviving. And, you know, here's a guy like John Steinbeck, right? And
famous writer.
Uh-huh, and one would think we were doing a pretty good job with John Steinbeck, and the answer is, no, we're not. And, you know, maybe we just leave it there. It's to say that there's huge amounts of room for improvement, and it's a very, very juicy area, very meaty. I don't want to do anything that only works for my site, because this is my profession, right? This is what I do. This kind of work is my work, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, what I want to do is, you know, do something that helps our whole culture make this transition so that we do a better job, you know, of creating this record that you're talking about and actually have it be something that you can depend on to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, it's always going to be to some extent. You know?
The public record is a great example of a fiction that takes on a kind of factual footing and becomes real to the extent that we believe the fiction, you know?
Everything's like that, Jay. I mean,
there's a lot of things are like that, yeah.
We were talking about baseball at the beginning of the show. What exactly is real about baseball, right?
There is magic in our deceptions.
Exactly. Hey, man, I think maybe this is a good place to leave it, huh?
All right, Dave, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, we'll talk to you again next week, Jay.
Okay, good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.